Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. For today, we are going to continue with our series of monthly POTUS 47 conversations. Joining us here for the conversation today on this Friday, glad to welcome back Kurt Ryman, Head of Fixed Income for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. Kurt, thank you for dropping by. I know we have a lot to catch our listeners up on, so looking forward to our conversation. Welcome back.
Me too. Thanks for having me back on the show, Dan.
Definitely. And before we begin quickly, I want to remind our listeners, our clients, that they can stay informed on POTUS 47 coverage by visiting the UBS website, ubs.com/POTUS47, where you will find regular updates and resources as it relates to POTUS 47. So, Kurt, we do have a lot to cover, so let's dive right in. I know as we're speaking today here on Friday, October 17th, the U.S. government shutdown is at this point well into week 3. What dialogue negotiation is taking place amongst lawmakers in order to restore the impacted government functions, services, and what factors have been holding up progress?
Yeah, so quickly, just on a report card for where things stand, the shutdown, it started on the 1st of October, so it's easy to track how many days we're in. Today represents the 17th day. And that's notable because the last time we had a full government shutdown was in 2013. And guess what? It ended on the 17th. So we are going to be, by this weekend, at the longest full government shutdown since 2013. By Monday, we're going to be on day 20. On Wednesday, it'll be the start of the fourth week. And to your question, there's very little substantive that would suggest that lawmakers are close to ending this shutdown. At issue is this enhanced premium subsidies that for the Affordable Care Act. These expire at the end of the year, and Democrats are using the shutdown to press for those subsidies to be extended. And Republicans so far are unwilling and potentially even unable to secure the necessary votes to extend them, especially during a shutdown. What's interesting is that the subsidies that expire would lead to rising healthcare premiums somewhere on the order of 12 million. It would affect 12 million Republicans and about 9 million Democrats. So in theory, this issue would garner bipartisan support. We're not living in an era of bipartisanship on these issues, and it's especially on issues related to federal spending. So we've seen some, kind of early trial balloons that have been floated. You might have heard recently Majority Leader Thune suggested they could that they would put a vote to the floor of the Senate, but that's not a guarantee. And the vote would, of course, be on the expired subsidies and extending them. So, and then on the economic side, what are the forcing mechanisms? What would bring, the parties together? And it would be things like, a weaker economy, or maybe the poll numbers start blaming, the Americans start blaming one party or the other. And there hasn't been really much of a, obvious impact on the economy from the shutdown. The administration has already taken some moves to pay active duty troops and law enforcement officers. And if you look at the poll numbers, Americans are saying basically that both parties are equally to blame. That'll shift. And that's probably what's going to end up being the forcing mechanism for this shutdown to end. But right now, there's little evidence that the shutdown's going to end anytime soon. It could very likely drag into November.
So, Kurt, with that, in terms of impact at this point to financial markets, economic activity, is there anything notable to point to?
Not really. The equity market has not been taking its cues from the government shutdown. We're in the midst of Q3 earnings season. Last weekend, there was you know, some a little bit of a minor tremor around tariffs, which as at least seems to be fading. Some concerns, as I'm sure you and previous guests talked about, on the some of the fraud that's been creeping into credit markets. So yeah, that's largely been the driver of financial markets. And yeah, it's too early for the shutdown to be impacting the economy. And in any case, we don't have too many examples of government shutdowns that have lasted longer than a week. There's really three. And the last one was in 2018. It lasted for 34 days. It was partial. And just as a reminder, because we talked about this last time, Congressional Budget Office did a study, and their take was that it cut about 0.02% off of potential GDP in 2019. So, like, basically a rounding error. And that's because any funds that aren't dispersed in the form of salaries will get paid. They'll get made up in once the government reopens. So there's some, you know, there's some part of the economy that gets permanently lost from a shutdown, but it's not a lot. We'd have to see this last much longer. Other drivers are far more powerful. That's something that, you know, we said ahead of the shutdown, which is, you know, if you think about the 2018-2019 shutdown, the impact was far more around the Fed raising rates and the what at that point was some of the delayed effect of some tariff action that had taken place earlier in the year. And likewise, this time around, you know, the Fed is in rate cutting mode. The earnings have come out pretty well for the financials that have reported so far. And the economic data has mostly held up, and the tariff news wasn't enough yet to cause any, you know, sort of lasting damage.
Well, Kurt, that was a very helpful update in terms of how we got to where we are today, where negotiations currently stand, and hearing about the scope of impact to financial markets and economic activity. Another topic to spend some time on today separately, we have seen financial markets rattled recently by renewed trade tensions involving the U.S. and China. Kurt, do you have a sense for where relations stand as of today? What exactly triggered this recent volatility? And there's a previously suggested upcoming meeting involving President Trump and President Xi Jinping still on track?
Seems to be on track. I'd say that coming into the weekend last Friday, it was a series of microaggressions that, you know, kind of minor irritants that were, well, you know, they weren't really minor, depending on the perspective. Whether it was some port fees on ships or changes in export restrictions or adding companies to these entity lists. These are, you know, we kind of had a period of coming together around these summits in various cities, and the mood music was, you know, kind of moving in the right direction. But these minor microaggressions that were coming on were just kind of building on one another. And it's hard to say, you know, was one side playing offense or another side playing defense. It's hard to say which side, if we wanted to, started it. It was kind of just a series of escalations. And then it ended up with the threatened 100% additional tariffs on China and the rare earth restrictions coming back onto the radar screen, and then of course it faded. But this is, I would read this as both sides trying to get maximum leverage going into whatever next meeting they will have, which is around the APEC summit, and being able to use that as the starting point for a series of follow-on discussions. And so yeah, we escalated, we de-escalated. We could be in for, you know, kind of repeated periods of escalation. But our base case is that neither side wants this to turn into a lasting heightened war that would lead to economic damage. China can't afford it. It's, you know, working to prevent deflation and the leverage that built up over many years from undermining the economy. And, you know, the administration is really working hard here to support economic activity. So the idea of getting back to something that we saw in April seems like that landing, you know, we're going to land on a zone that's around where we are now of, in our view, somewhere between 30 to 40% tariffs on China. We're at 40 now. So it's, you know, what matters, Dan, is the summit. What matters also is the relationship between the two leaders, but also something that's not getting a whole lot of airtime. And, I won't go into too much detail, but the Supreme Court is going to be taking up the oral arguments on November 5th in the case that's been working its way through the lower courts, the Court of International Trade, the U.S. Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. Both had ruled that the tariffs on China, the fentanyl tariffs, the baseline tariffs, the tariffs on Canada and Mexico, the ones on Brazil, these are under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, better known as IEEPA. That's going in front of the Supreme Court on the 5th of November. They're going to hear the oral arguments. They're going to hear from both sides, and they're going to have a decision before the end of the year or early next year, whether they're legal or not. And if they're illegal, well, you know, then we have kind of a status quo. If they're illegal, the whole landscape changes on tariffs. And so I guess when we think about the tariff impact on financial markets, just sort of, you know, bringing it home, you know, what does it mean for the markets? We have been through a period where the view around these higher tariffs has been largely, you know, the markets have taken it in stride. It's been a border adjustment tax. We haven't really gotten into an all-out trade war. There have been deals. So it's allowed the market to trend higher. From here, yeah, the landscape's going to change. We're not at a point where we can say that it's going to change in a way that is potentially damaging for markets and the economy. But we do have to be on the lookout. We have to be following this. We have to be really, you know, sort of not taking this view that just because tariffs haven't been bad they've been benign, that they will continue to be. So, I think it's something that we will be keeping a close eye on. But as far as the China-U.S. Relationship goes, you know, 30% or so of the tariffs that have been imposed, maybe that's too high, closer to 25, have been in this category of IEEPA. And if they're declared illegal and they go away, companies are going to get a huge windfall because they'll be entitled to a refund if they paid those tariffs. And, you know, and we may end up in a much lower, you know, tariff zone between the U.S. and China. So, or maybe slightly lower tariff zone than we see today. So there are potentially positive outcomes. We may end up in a world where both countries end up, you know, using export restrictions more. But it's just to say that the landscape could be quite different in a couple of months from now, depending on the Supreme Court ruling. So we'll stay tuned.
Yes, indeed. And Kurt, I know our next conversation is coming up in just a few weeks' time. So hopefully at that point, the government shutdown will be in the rear view, as it sounds like there is a lot to discuss and be mindful of when it comes to U.S. trade policy and these ongoing negotiations with China. So Kurt, thank you again for dropping by the podcast, keeping our listeners, our clients informed, and do look forward to our next upcoming conversation.
Same here. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Kurt. You as well. Again, today we have been joined by Kurt Ryman, Head of Fixed Income Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. Again, I do want to point you, our listeners, to the POTUS 47 website, which updates on a regular basis with resources as it relates to POTUS 47 from the UBS Chief Investment Office. That's ubs.com/POTUS47. From UBS Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.